Welcome to Feels Like Healing, a series of conversations between myself, Al Lewis, and individuals who have turned to creativity as a way of helping them heal. Our need for healing is universal, however, the reasons behind it can be oh so varied. A difficult childhood, a traumatic experience, or perhaps a bereavement and our need to process grief. My search for healing stems from the death of my dad, who died when I was 21 from multiple sclerosis. I believe that hearing other people's stories can help us to process ours, and that the act of being creative can help turn something seemingly hopeless and incomprehensible into something beautiful and hopeful. These conversations are here to provide solace and inspiration, and to show you that healing can happen when we take our deepest pain and turn it into a work of art. This is Feels Like Healing. My guest this week on Feels Like Healing is the broadcaster, star of the BBC's hit show The Repair Shop, and now author, Susie Fletcher, and also, of course, not forgetting, Master Saddler. She has just recently released her new memoir, The Sun Over the Mountains, a beautiful book which I've enjoyed reading over the last couple of weeks, which is detailing Susie's life as she went from a young 16-year-old moving to London to study leatherwork to then ending up in Denver, Colorado, and being married within 3 months of touching down, and everything after that, which we will discuss. So hello, Susie, first of all, how are you?
I'm really well, Al. Thank you so much. You really have read the book, haven't you?
Well, it's only you got to do due diligence when you're a podcaster and make sure you know the person you're talking to. I do feel like, having read the book, that I do know you a bit more, which is always probably a bit disconcerting when you're being interviewed and you realise that the person on the other side knows a lot about your life.
Well, it's interesting how the actual writing of the book came along, because anyone that knows me knows that I'm actually an introvert and I really like to be quiet. So to find myself being persuaded to put pen to paper and talk about something very publicly, but this week was released in America as well. It's all out there, Al. I mean, there's nothing I can do about it. So it's very liberating. I think, you know, naturally I tend to sort of hide, and maybe that's not the healthiest thing for a human to do. Yeah. So I think there's absolutely all about balance. And I feel now in my 60s, what's the worst that can happen?
That's a good mantra to have, I think. It stops us from doing things that perhaps we're scared of. And I think that's something that came through in your book, is that you're often somebody, it seems like, that is willing to dip your toe in the water and go for things, even if they are a bit scary. Am I right?
Yes. I call my life the life of happy accidents, because the opportunities present themselves in the first place, and my instinct is to go, oh, no, I couldn't possibly. And then this other brain kicks in and goes, for goodness sakes, woman, just get on with it. What's the worst that can happen? And thankfully, I tend to override the maybe cautious and somewhat sensible brain with this let's go for it attitude. And to date, touch wood, it's been more positive than negative.
Definitely. As I'm sure you're aware, the podcast is about how we use creative means to help us through grief and trauma, and this stems from me using my musicality and my music as a way to better deal with and process the grief of losing my dad when I was 21. And a large segment of your book is about your relationship with your late husband and the difficulties of that relationship, but obviously one of the first loves of your life has been horses and saddlery, and that obviously comes through across a lot in the book. So I wanted to perhaps start there and ask, when did that love of working with leather and saddlery and the love of animals and being with horses, when did that first come to you?
It's interesting when you reflect back, you know, when was the first moment that you think you noticed? And I do mention in the book, it was something that my dad used to laugh about, that he He said, my first word was horse. I was captivated by these just magnificent animals that we as humans are very much used for our own needs through, you know, many, many hundreds of years. And they are magnificent animals. In writing the book and looking at my personality and my love of music as well, there is a rhythm with riding a horse, as there is rhythm in music. And I do have a chaotic brain, which is, you know, the dyslexic brain, and the understanding, you know, what calms the brain down for me. And certainly being in the presence of a horse, I find really calming. And then to be on a horse and you have that rhythm and that you have that unity of horse and rider, and they have a brain, they can do whatever they want. And there's that sort of really deep spiritual respect for one another. All of these things, of course, I was a child, I had no idea why, it just felt right. Mm-hmm. It really felt right. And I love all animals and nature, but particularly the horse is what grabbed me.
I'm always intrigued by people who seem to have a calling very early in life, because for me, I never envisaged becoming a musician until I was sort of 21, 22, having lost my dad. But you left home at 16 to study at, am I right in saying, is it called Cordwainers College? Were you quite adamant at that age that this was the path for you and you were going to work with horses and work with leather?
Yeah, well, that's how this all came about. I had, as a child, and my parents' influence, been introduced to this wonderful material called leather. We had a local glove factory. The area around here was very well known for raising sheep and glove leathers. So it was from that. And then obviously there's lots of leather involved in tack and harness. And I just loved this material. So it was a series again of happy accidents and opportunities that I was introduced to the local saddlemaker. And he saw that I was really, really interested and had a flair. I mean, I wasn't interested in anything else other than horses and leather. That was it. And it was in an era when women weren't master saddlers. They could become bridle makers. We're talking the 1970s. But he was such a maverick, and he went, actually, why not? Why shouldn't you? So I was still at school at this point, and I wasn't academic because of my dyslexia, which wasn't a thing back in them days. I went and worked for him part-time, school holidays and the like, and managed to find myself place at Cordwainers. And I had to do, because I was 16, I had to do what they called a pre-entry or pre-access course, which did the footwear and leather goods, which I really didn't want to do because all I wanted to do was saddlery. But here we are all these years later, and I realized how valuable it was to have the introduction to footwear and leather goods, because pretty much handle anything, I think, that's made of leather. You know, there you go. You look back and go, wow, who would have known that that would come in so valuable all these years later? And so 16, leaving this market town in Oxfordshire and going, yeah, no, that's good. It's fine. But we were always brought up to know that at 16, you were expected to leave home. Sounds rather harsh. Expected to leave home either to go to work, go to education, or get married. I'm like, well, yeah, that's not happening. So I chose the sensible thing. Let's go and get an education and a life education, you know, living in the East End of London. That was fun.
And did you find much sexism and prejudice against you as a young woman trying to make it in that world? Not many women were doing this at that time.
You look back at the culture, I mean, it was an era, let's face it. It was what it was. And so none of it really fazed me, because I was used to that sort of interaction with men going, You're just a pretty little thing, aren't you? There, there. A little bit of that, but there was always a part of me that just thought, but I'm going to do this, so it doesn't really matter what they think. And I did. Interestingly, now, you know, all these years later and having come back, you know, some of the old guard are still around and they're saying, we always knew you'd make it. But did you? It's, you know, massively changed. Life has massively changed. Attitudes have massively changed. And it is just very strange to think that there was a period in my life where I was treated as less than from a profession.
Yeah. Well, yeah, thankfully things have moved on, if not as much as we'd all hope, but...
We're getting there.
Yeah, we're getting there, exactly. So then in your 20s, you plough on with your career in the UK, and then at what point comes this idea to up sticks and move to America? Where did that come from?
Well, I also, I'm one of four children, and I'm the only one that seems to have this wanderlust gene. Not necessarily interested in going overseas for holidays because I can't sit still. But I really wanted to explore what else was out there. And prior to in the States, I had done a little bit of traveling to New Zealand and backpacked back in the day before mobile phones and all of those security blankets. You know, if you're going to do it big, go by yourself, go somewhere that you don't know anybody. And I remember my dad gave me a phone card, only for emergencies though. So I could phone home and say, I'm lost, I don't know where I'm. So I'd come back to the UK and I'd been doing some work for somebody in America, and they introduced me to some people that were looking for a master saddler. And again, it was this weird and wonderful winding path that eventually brought me to end up in Boulder, Colorado with fabulous Linda. But America, funnily enough, had never really appealed to me because I just thought it's pretty advanced. And you know, I'd already made up my mind as what America was. And there's another lesson for you.
Were you looking for a change in your life? Do you think that was a part of something in the decision to go across the world?
Yes, I think I was. At that time, I had a job. I was perfectly happy working for somebody. I had a relationship. I was perfectly happy. But there was something missing. And I think I felt that I was in my 30s, early 30s, and I just knew that I needed to break out. I really did. And it meant obviously leaving my job. The relationship was coming to an end. It took several months for this all to come to fruition, but I needed a change. And it was scary. You know, there was quite a few false starts and there were people not following through. So there was lots of hurdles that we had to navigate before I eventually landed in Boulder, Colorado.
What was that like, that change of culture?
You know, the Midwest where I was very much cowboys, very much ranching. And I was thrown into this incredible town or city, Boulder, Colorado, which is university town, very liberal, surrounded by a lot of conservatives. And so there was lots of them and us, which I thought was quite interesting. And the ranchers are, you know, they are gritty. They are nuts and bolts. You know your place when you're dealing with a rancher, not in a threatening way, in a way of they are very clear as to what their views are and they do let you know. So I'm somebody I feel is happy to listen to everybody's point of view, and it's not my job to try and influence somebody some other way, and you probably wouldn't, anyway, they've become gritty because of their heritage. And you look at the history of America, and particularly the ranchers, how hard they have had to work to get through things like the Depression and the Dust Bowl and maintaining the land after they'd come across the land in the wagons, and the really tough life that they had. You can see where that has been instilled in the previous, in the generations, because it's been handed down, those battles of life. And I thought that that was really quite cool. I love it when people are really themselves. I find it very comfortable because there's no pretense there. And you can handle the reality. You know where you stand, and they know where they stand with you, because you can have that open, this is me and that's you. So it was really liberating. It was really lovely.
I quite liked in the book how you say that you took, is it 2 suitcases and your toolbox?
Yes.
And that's all you took, and how that toolbox has obviously been with you along all these journeys in your life. And so has that been like a grounding for you? Was that really helpful in settling into a brand new place like Boulder, and sort of knowing that you had those tools to help you? You could still do what you loved no matter where you were. Was that a comfort?
Again, I hadn't ever sort of really analysed it, but having a skill and an ability that someone or something wants from you, that is your area of security. You know your job, you know your skill, and you can go anywhere in the world, and that's what you do. It's almost like that is your security blanket as well. It is for me what design, it is for me what my character is, my personality is. It's definitely all the people that I work for in America, when they mention Susie in the horse world, they know who Susie is, and it's Susie the saddle maker. So it defines me as a person, which I've find, again, very grounding, very comfortable. It's my go-to if life is getting very stressful. I can go to the bench and I can just lose myself in my work, and then everything's fine.
Mm. And that comes through definitely in the chapters where you talk about the difficulties you had with your husband, Rob. It sounded like it was quite a whirlwind relationship. You got together and were married within 3 months, if I'm right in recalling.
But you don't want to waste any time, do you?
But also there was a dark side and a tormented side to him, and an abusive side to him. And you're very open and frank about that in the book. I wondered, first of all, how it felt like to open up about those things in writing and putting it all out there for people, and also whether you reflect, and in hindsight, was your creativity and your saddlery work, was that something that helped you during that tumultuous time to sort of know? Because there's often pieces where you say you would go to your workshop and that would help you recover from whatever traumatic episode had just happened between the two of you.
The relationship was very interesting, I would say. And the problem with my husband is that he had some behavioral issues that had come about through various experiences through his life. And one of the things I said when this opportunity came along was, if I was going to do it, I was going to be very, very honest, and there would be this dark subject matter running through. But that was the reason why I decided to write the book, because unfortunately, the figures are showing that domestic violence and abuse has been on a steady increase. And it did get horribly, horribly during the lockdown pandemic that we went through, adding insult to injury on top of everything that we were going through. I knew that there were people out there that were trapped. And it's an area of life that's been spoken about by many, many, many people. But what I feel for myself I wanted to get across is that never did I stop loving my husband. And I always tried to find a reason as to why he was acting out this time. And as it was my marriage and my relationship, these were the coping tools that I came to, going to the bench, having the horses in my life, the animals, music, which I have in my life anyway. When the dust settled, whether we were able to talk about what happened, why it happened, and often we couldn't and he wouldn't. But here we are so many years later, where so much more is known about mental well-being or mental health issues, which clearly my husband did suffer from. He did what most people do who have had significant trauma, and I don't share what he went through because A, he's not here, and B, it was stacking. I mean, it wasn't just one incident. It was lots of things that I can look at and go, absolutely makes sense why he was fried. Because in order for him to try and cope with his trauma, he did what most people do, and he turned to drugs and alcohol. It's the easiest thing to do, and you can understand why people go there, because it numbs the pain, and that's all anyone's trying to do that's gone anything through anything, is distract from the distress and the pain. And that's why, you know, people get addicted to work and addicted to other things. And I know it through myself. I have an addictive personality. I have to find healthy addictions, because that's what keeps me calm and engaged in the moment and on a positive path and not a destructive path.
Well, I'd certainly consider the memoir that you've created to be certainly a positive way to cope and to heal. And did you find it difficult, though, to sort of relive those times and to put them down on paper?
Yes, it was. So I worked with a ghostwriter because, you know, obviously being dyslexic, that was going to be a challenge to actually try and write it. And on our first recording, because we would have video chat, I just purged, and probably for 2 hours. And afterwards, I said to her, I'm ever so sorry. I'm so, so sorry. And she said, you've got it out your system now, and now we can move on. And it was so liberating. And I just felt all of this tension just leave my body, because I had never spoken at this detail to anybody
really
about it ever. And it was that moment, all right, here we go. If you're going to do it, you're going to do it to absolute maximum. Get it out of your system. We didn't really focus on specifics. There's a couple, one or two in there, because every time I revisit those moments, my body goes into reacting the same way. So why would I want to do that to my body? And I have learned that through the years, is do not revisit the bad, revisit the good, because the good actually uplifts your body. So that's where I tend to focus my energies. And there was so much that was actually good about the relationship. We just had this massive problem that was sort of under the water of the surface that was always present. It was just, when was it going to get a bit stormy?
Has it been a catharsis for you to have it expelled out of you, like you say, that sort of unleashing, having not spoken to anybody about it before? And perhaps, I suppose, then therefore for your family to read it, it's probably been maybe a bit of a revelation for them as well.
I think that's one of the things that sort of still sort of gets me, that my siblings had no idea. I mean, Steve, my brother, who's on the show with me, he knew things were cool and groovy, but he didn't know to the extent. And I chose not to tell them, as I chose not to tell anybody. And this is very, very typical, is you sort of feel that you got yourself in this mess, it's up to you to sort it out. And I certainly couldn't worry my family. They're 4,500 miles away. So that would have been a cruel thing for me to do. And so this is, you know, I'm just figuring it out as I go along. And so, yes, putting it out in the world has been massively cathartic. And the outpouring from various people, men and women from all over the world now, has been so incredibly touching and supportive. Some people have shared their own experiences. Some people have, men have said, we're not all rotters, you know. And I was like, well, he wasn't a rotter, you know, he wasn't a rotter. So it's good for me to sort of maintain that open-minded understanding of what he went through as much as I try to do with everybody that comes into my life. You know, we're all in this together. We're all doing the best that we can, managing all of the emotions that we all share. And we're only human at the end of the day.
No, I certainly think you've done him no disservice at all, in terms of you haven't painted him as a monster at all. I think you've painted him as a human being with complex issues like we all have. But one part of the book which really was very poignant and touching to me was when you were describing the end of life care that you were giving to Rob, and those last few months and weeks when you decided to go on trips and sort of on your motorbikes and really make memories, like you were saying the oncologist had told you to do, and the passage where you talk about those last few days as well. And it was really, really quite moving to see that sort of discussion about end of life care and death in general, which I think I certainly agree with you in how you say that people who work in palliative care are saints, and we really need to value them and appreciate them more. But was that something you felt important about talking about?
Yeah, very much so. You know, we all know it's going to happen to us one day. So I find it quite interesting how we're sort of brought up not really being terribly comfortable talking about it. My husband, he was very eclectic in his nationality, but it was heavily on the Hispanic side, and they go into this massive wailing, and they're not afraid to show their emotions. They're very open, and they're very, very open also with the production of life. They get so excited when a new life comes into the world. And I got to see this really uncloseted emotion around life experiences through his family. And I really appreciated that, because open myself to my emotions, and cried on camera, I laugh easily. Emotions are emotions. And what I went through it with nursing Rob was such a life's opportunity. I honestly felt so privileged to be there for him. This was a huge man with great strengths and mental strengths to be cut down by cancer, which so many people can relate to. And watching somebody leave you short, you know, over a period of time, my job was to look after him and give him whatever he wanted. And nothing else mattered at that time. It was merely that's what I had to do. And so I felt by sharing it, it hopefully gives comfort to people who have gone through it, are going through it, or have never, ever listened to somebody share that experience. For me, it was a beautiful thing to be able to do, in the most intimate part of any relationship I've ever shared.
Well, it certainly comes across that way as well, a beautiful piece. Is there a feeling, having put this book out, that it's helped you heal personally?
Yes, definitely. I think for so long I'd called this aspect of the relationship, my dirty little secret. You know, everybody thought, oh, she's had an amazing time living in America for 22 years and all the experiences she had. And, you know, all of that was true. But I just felt that there was a part that I'd locked away, and I'm not somebody who is not honest. There's that fine line, isn't there, between privacy and putting it all out there. And one of the things I find quite challenging sometimes is other people's perception of how you must be and how your life must be and how it must have been. And you know, it wasn't quite like that. I'm trying to be very careful with my own perception of, you know, what somebody's scenario is, because, you know, you can make snap decisions and judge somebody when you haven't really sort of seen the whole picture of that person. And it's lovely when you talk to people, you can tell by the questions that are coming your way how broad-minded they are, or whether they've got a specific perception of you. And, you know, all of these things I'm sort of learning through being out in the world and talking to multiple people from multiple mediums. And it's, life is really quite interesting.
It's interesting you talk about the repair shop at the beginning of the book, but it sort of comes into your life having returned to the UK following Rob's death. You decided to sell up and come back to the UK. What you do now, you were saying before how, you know, if you have a skill, you can always go somewhere where people need that skill, and you can apply that skill. But there's something special about what you do now, in that it's more than the exchange of money. You're enabling people to reconnect with memories and to heal as well themselves. So I wonder if that application of your creative talent is rewarding in a different way, and how that feels to be able to apply your talent in a way that helps other people so visibly and so clearly.
Yes, it's taken us all by surprise, actually, that this premise of somebody coming into a barn with an item which they then don't go on to explain a story as to why this item is so important to them, and we fix this item and they come in, and it's this whole journey for them, which, listening to their stories, and you only get to see or hear this much story, we get to hear the whole shebang. And there have been moments where we've actually had to stop filming because all of us were so affected by the sharing and people's upfrontness and willingness to share. And it's lovely to hear somebody's story, because we all have a story in us, and it's done with no judgment, and it actually is what they probably need, and they feel better. And we have so many people come in that say, oh, well, I wasn't going to cry, but there's something. As soon as you walk in those big doors, there is a vibe change in the barn. It's safe and it's caring and it's genuine. It's why it's been so successful. And oh, by the way, we happen to be making a television program, which we forget about. I think for me, it's been just that recognition of, I think there's no better feeling than making somebody else happy. Mm. And that's what I'm able to do on a regular basis. And that will never get old, because it's so individual.
Yeah. And like you say, when you know that something that you've done has touched somebody else, that there's not much that can beat that, is there?
Nope. There's nothing. It's priceless. It's utterly priceless.
The other thing I really liked about your book, being a musician, is that you ended each chapter with a song or an artist that sort of encapsulated that time for you in your life. So is music still a prevalent part of your life, and is it still provide you with comfort and a way of perhaps looking back, but in a positive way?
Yeah, gosh, I mean, there's so much we could talk about with music, you being a musician, and I've listened to your work and it's really rather lovely.
Thank you.
The first one I listened to was the one you wrote for your dad and that made him cry. Thank you. But yes, having music on in the workshop is really delightful because it just spirits you to another place whilst you're doing your work. For me, it really is healthy for my brain. As I say, it is a quite busy brain, so that rhythm of music definitely helps to keep it calm, along with my copious amounts of energy to where I need to get rid of it sometimes, so to dance. And I'm not a great dancer, but I don't really mind. It's okay. I'm just doing my thing. And I think we all do it, don't we, where you hear a track and you're like, oh, my word, that takes me back to that. Do you remember when? And isn't that a lovely thing for music to be able to do, just to transport you to time gone by and just make you laugh, make you cry, make you go, yeah, that was a good time. And just make you more appreciative of time itself, because, you know, this very moment that you and I are exchanging this conversation, it is a moment in time, and it's the present is so important, more so than the past and more so than the future. It's the now that really matters. And so when something pops into your brain that comes from music, or imagine you as a musician, you must be absorbing life for other reasons as inspiration to your next track.
I'm very much in the same camp as you about living in the present and trying to be present in what we're doing, which isn't always easy. I wonder, I certainly think that loss and the loss of my dad certainly reinforced that in me. Do you think the loss of Rob and going through that period of looking after him and grieving him, do you think that has made that aspect of your life, your mentality, your outlook change, or just reinforced it?
Yeah, I think probably reinforced it, because it was the first time, it's the only time I've ever had somebody looking into my eyes as they died. I've had animals where I've seen the life leave their eyes, and I've witnessed death of a human prior to this, but this was so incredibly moving in a wondrous way that I'm not afraid of dying, because it is going to happen, but it does make me so aware of every moment is a gift. It is precious. For a long time after his death, and with all that I was dealing with the farm and closing everything down, I wasn't present. I wasn't in my right mind, or I was actually spiraling down, because all of this stuff I could now let down. And I was lucky that I had my work, the horses, the animals, to keep me grounded, because that would have been the time that I could have gone off the rails and not wanted to get out of bed, and not seen the point in, you know, looking after myself. You have to keep your body healthy and keep moving. So, yes, I think I value things for what they are. I value life things rather than material stuff. And I'm very grateful that I still wake up every morning, and it's another opportunity to do something that's enjoyable.
We've alluded to your work and music, obviously. The title, The Sun Over the Mountains, alludes to perhaps your love of nature. I was wondering, what are the other things that help you stay grounded and help you appreciate life and heal? Have you still got a motorbike? Have you bought one in the UK, or was that just an American thing?
I vacillate between, do I regret not bringing Birdie home or not? It's one of those things that I think belonged in America because the roads aren't quite as safe in the UK for motorcyclists. And it is a fact, it's quite dangerous to be on the roads. But with nature, like this morning, I went out on the horse around the fields and the tracks. The fields are now harvested and you've got the pheasants running around and you just can't help but go, how lucky am I, you know, just to have the health and the ability to go out and just really live in nature. And if it's not too hot this evening, I'll go out on my push bike, which I like to do of an evening for the very same reasons. And you see sunset go down now, but just being out in the world and just looking around and watching life and being part of life, I think it's probably what it's all about.
Yeah. And to close, do you still have the same relationship with leatherwork and saddlery as you did as that young 16-year-old, or has it changed, or does it still give you that same satisfaction as it once did? Is it still something you would do out of pure pleasure, or is it just do you see it just as a job now? Is it still something more than that?
It's never been a job. That's the beauty of it. It's just, you know, that old adage, if you do what you love, you never work a day in your life. And you know, as cliche as that sounds, that's the truth. Presently, I'm busy with this TV gig. Who knows what the future holds? I'm always designing. I don't have a lot of time for the saddles at the moment, but one of the things I do tend to do when I'm out riding is go into design mode and think about the biomechanics of awesome rider engaging. And I'm a female, and you know, you just kind of understand what women need as a rider. And my brain likes to think about design, research and development. So I will always be working with leather and designing. It's part of my makeup. And I'm so, so grateful that I found my bliss early on in life, because it has given me a lot of security, and it's the thing that I can count on.
Well, beautifully said. Well, thank you for talking to me today, Susie, and thank you for sharing your story and opening up in an honest and truthful way about, like you say, difficult things, but things that I feel need to be talked about. So The Sun Over the Mountains is available now in all good bookstores, and I thoroughly recommend you go and read it. Thank you, Susie.
Thank you, Al. It's been a pleasure. Have a lovely day.
Please help by rating and subscribing to this podcast, as it will help to spread the word about Feels Like Healing. Thanks for listening.